The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode number 601 for Sunday, April 17th, 2016. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, we answer your questions, we also share your tips, and yes, today we'll share a little bit of cool stuff found because that's fun. The goal, of course, being each of us learn at least three new things every time we get together and have fun doing it. Sponsors for this episode include ProXPN. We're at proxpn.com/MacGeekGab. You can get a free VPN and more. We'll talk about that later. Also, Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com. Some of the best upgrades you'll ever find. We'll talk more about that later, too, here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How you doing today, John F. Braun?
Toasty.
Are you toasty today?
I'm not up there.
Yeah, it's supposed to be in the 60s here today.
It's there now, so...
Is it? I'm busy recording. I don't know what it's,
well,
what it's like.
Well, I glanced at the outdoor portion of my weather station while I was out and about. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We're at 59 here, according to my weather station. So we'll get there by the end of the show. It feels like it's 59 in the studio, though. My stupid Nest thermostat, man, they updated the firmware and they re-enabled auto away mode or turned it on, and I'd previously had it off. So like, if it doesn't detect that you're in the environment where the thing is, it wouldn't even turn on for my schedule at 10 a.m. this morning. It's like, well, what good is this? Why do I set a schedule? I
feel like I'm able to override this sort of,
well, I can. And I had in the past, I had turned it off, but it's like, even if you have this auto away thing, don't you think that maybe the concept of setting a schedule means I know something you don't? I'm going to be home, so make sure you heat that thing up. And then maybe if it gets to 10:30 and it's not detecting that I'm in the room or whatever, then, okay, you know what? Let's back off. Let's not have it run until, you know, whatever, 12 or 1. But it, I mean, it should follow the schedule. That's crazy talk. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah, it's not so good. I don't know. It's the Nest is a weird thing for colder climates, I think. It doesn't, I have found other thermostats that work better. The Ecobee is far and away the better of the smart thermostats for climates that are not temperate.
Well, Nest, aren't they in California?
Exactly. No, I've always said.
They don't know what we have to go through here.
No, but I mean, it's like perfect for that climate. It really is. And the Ecobee, it'll come as no surprise. They are based out of Toronto, right? So it, you know.
Yeah, they get it.
They get it. Well, yeah, but it's just two different paradigms. You know, here's the thing about the Nest. The Nest is built with the assumption that people don't know how to program their regular non quote unquote smart programmable thermostats. And if you don't know how to program your thermostat, you can actually save some money if this thing, you know, is intelligent about it. But here's the thing. No one in my neck of the woods here could afford to not learn how to program their thermostat. Everybody understands how their house works. I mean, you have to figure this out. Otherwise it'll cost you thousands every year. And so everybody kind of already knows, you know, how to do it. And yes, there's some cool things the Nest could do. Like if you have it, say, you know, be on all day on Saturday and it turns out that Saturday you happen to be, you know, out skiing or something. Well, then great. You know, let it drop down. And that kind of stuff is cool. And also knowing how long it takes for your house to heat up from it one temperature to another based on outside conditions, all of that stuff. Very cool. But this assumption, the Ecobee folks did not build their product with the assumption that their customers are unable to do this on their own or I don't want to say uninformed, but that haven't learned how to do this on their own. They always have. So they take your learning and actually apply it. Whereas the Nest people are like, nah, whatever these schedules are that you've set, man, trust us. We know better. It's like, actually, no, you don't. but that's cool. You know, it's all good. Anyway, that was a rant I didn't expect to have. Yeah. But I'm a little cold, so, you know, that's what you get. Hey, before we get too deep into things today, I wanted to mention very quickly that the Podcast Awards 2016 nominations are open, and they are open until April 30th. But we would very much appreciate your nomination for this show in the technology category. Then once the nominations are in, and I don't know what the thresholds are or anything, but once they're in and they kind of settle all that out, then hopefully we'll make it on the ballot and then we'll ask you again to vote. But check it out, podcastawards.com. We'd love to get some recognition there. So that would be good. Did you sign up and nominate us, John?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, it's very, very easy. They make it super simple. It's just podcastawards.com.
So. Wait, I can nominate myself?
You can. Yeah. You can nominate other podcasts too. There's all kinds of categories and everything. Let your favorite podcasters know if you're nominating them, though. And the reason is that this year, podcasts, and you can nominate anyone, but they will only accept nominations for podcasts that have registered. It's a nominal fee of $10, which we've already done here for the show, obviously. But if you nominate your favorite podcaster, it doesn't matter if they get 1,000 nominations. If they haven't paid that $10 to be a part of the process, then they are not a part of the process. But you can nominate them, and then they can go and pay their $10. As long as they paid their $10 before April 30th, all nominations up through, you know, through the whole period count. So there you go. That's all I got on that one, John.
All right.
Shall we move into to cool stuff found here now that we're done with our ranting and all of that stuff? Is that good?
Sure.
Okay.
Dive right in.
All right. Scott writes, he actually has sort of two things. It's a cool stuff found and a quick tip. He says, I recently purchased the Belkin, I don't even know how to pronounce this, Q-O-D-E. Combination case and keyboard for my iPad Air 2. It's an absolutely terrific device that is as small as the Zooglu case I was using previously and just about the same price. He said, I just didn't like their, they don't have a keyboard, the Zooglu case. He says, there are keys mapped to specific functions for iOS, including one that mirrors the double press on the home button to bring up horizontal scrolling list of apps to flip through. I thought that was pretty cool until I stumbled upon what I think is even cooler. By force of habit, I hit Command Tab on my iOS or on my iPad's keyboard, and much to my surprise, a row of icons popped up just in the same way that they do on macOS or on OS 10. We're not calling it macOS yet, Scott. That's soon. Continuing to press Command Tab, cycled through them, and Shift Command Tab had the expected action of going backwards. I've always thought that the app switching feature on iOS was cumbersome, but this is terrific. I'm a keyboard fanatic from way back, and this feature adds one of my most used shortcuts to an iOS device. And then he wrote, and he said, it gets even better. On this keyboard, holding down the Command key brings up a context-sensitive menu of commands with keyboard shortcuts. In Mail, for example, you can use Command-R and Command-Shift-R to reply or reply all. In Safari, you can use Command-T for a new tab or Command-W to close one. With this keyboard and these shortcuts, I'm convinced more and more that I'll never go back to a laptop. So very cool, Scott. Thank you for sharing that. And we'll put a link to that Belkin keyboard, of course, in the show notes, because that's, you know, that's what we do. Cool stuff, huh, John? Do you use a keyboard with your iPad Air 2?
Not really.
Okay. No. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting.
Well, I got a secret. I'll share it with you.
Tell us your secret.
Cool stuff.
Yeah.
So in the past, they had a pref pane and a site called Secrets. As far as I can tell, it's gone. You can still download it from, you know, some places that make installers and install other things.
Sure.
So, but I did stumble across a site because I was searching for a tip. And the site, Dave, is, which should make sense to people that dabble in the terminal, but it's defaults-write.com.
Okay.
And it's basically, because a lot of times when you do something from the terminal to refine the behavior of OS X, sometimes you have to say defaults write, In the terminal,
sure,
which is the name of the site, and then you give a value and then a setting for that, or a parameter and then a setting for it. It does all sorts of interesting magical things. So as far as I can tell, that's current, and they have tips all the way up to 10.11. The one that caught my eye, though, is so they have one here that will tell you how to configure Time Machine to limit the size for a backup file, which is kind of cool.
Have you tried it? Does it work?
Well, I haven't tried it yet.
Okay.
I have to think how to orchestrate this, because I don't know if I necessarily want to do anything to an existing backup. So I'll create another one, then maybe fiddle with this.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. Yeah. But yeah. I've tried several of these things. I don't recall one using defaults right. I just remember editing the plist file of a Time Machine backup or of the bundle of a Time Machine backup, and then that helped. But defaults right, that's news to me. So I'm very curious. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Set up a size limit for backup volumes. Huh.
Yeah, they call it, and so looking at it, it's sudo defaults right, and then library preferences com.apple.timemachine max size.
Yeah.
So it's something that
cool.
is available, but as far as I know, not through the GUI. Which
right.
is probably a good thing, because I don't know if they want people necessarily fiddling with this.
Yeah. Yeah. They should let people fiddle with this, by the way. But, you know, it's
cool. I think they should. So you wouldn't have to partition a backup drive, which right now is, you know, pretty much a standard strategy for people that want to use a disk for Time Machine.
Yeah.
You create a partition just for Time Machine, and you make it as big as you think it should be.
Right. Right.
Or you set the quota with, if you have your Synology or another NAS that has an operating system, it'll typically let you dynamically set that.
Some of them will. Yeah, you're right. That Synology will with quotas. But actually, Synology's quotas are interesting, because I have a USB drive connected to my Synology, and that's where I have it store my Time Machine backups. But the Synology quotas don't apply to external volumes, only to the volumes it defines. So it's like, oh, awesome. I say that. I honestly have not looked at that particular aspect of it since I installed DSM-6. So maybe it's changed, but I doubt it. But, you know, anything's possible. Hey, I got another one. I found, actually, it was Victor Cahiao from... he does all kinds of things, doesn't he? But used to do the Typical Mac User podcast. But he posted a link to an app called Download Shuttle, which is a downloader. It makes life a download accelerator. It lets you manage and accelerate your downloads. It'll start multiple streams to pull downloads down, which can sometimes actually greatly increase the speed. And they've got plugins for Safari and all of that, so it just sort of attaches to the existing download thing. So check it out, put it out there. Thanks, Victor. He posted that to Facebook and couldn't ignore it. It was good stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's his, so he does something called TerraTech.
TerraTech, that's like, I don't know why
that escaped me. Well, I'll paste that in our room here. And
great.
It looks like he's currently doing that. It's the last update was on April 1st, and it looks like it comes out monthly. So,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Listener Michael hipped us to the fact that Best Buy has refurbished Apple Watch Sports. The 38 millimeters start at $211.65, so... prices going down on Apple Watches, which is good. I like the fact that they've got the refurbs out there. So if anybody's interested, there you go. And thank you, Michael. I think that's only in store, but maybe not. Maybe it's online too. Actually, I think maybe it is online based on what he's saying here. So you ready for the next one, John?
Yes, sir.
Listener Jim says, after I travel a lot, both for business and pleasure. One of my challenges has been to find the right tool to carry all of my accessories, lightning cables, USB cables, Bluetooth headsets, Apple Pencil, and more. I tried a bunch of different things, but one day while surfing through Amazon, I found the, what's it? It's a weird name. It's the Bubm, B-U-B-M, Portable Universal Wrap Organizer. I like it for a few reasons. First, it's got a lot of options for storage, zipper pockets, elastic band holders. Second, it wraps to a pretty small size, even loaded up with accessories. Third, the way it rolls, it allows me to stuff it almost anywhere. In particular, I like that it fits neatly into the drink holder sleeve on the outside of most backpacks. I like the product so much, I have two of them pre-packaged at all times. One has my short trip supplies. The other has the additional stuff I'll need when I'm gone for a week or more. Makes it really easy to pack for trips on short notice and helps me to not forget anything. When I'm home or at work, I just keep everything in the case and pull out what I need. Thanks, Jim. Great stuff. And we will put a link to that in the show notes too. It's that's pretty cool. Bub M. On the subject of headphones, Donna writes, for under $50 for a pair of earbuds, your listeners could check out Yourbuds at yurbuds.com. She says, I have the Inspire 400, Apple compatible for music and phone calls. My problem is that I have very small ear canals. Most fall out even if I think of moving my head. These are amazing. I can tug on the cord and they still stay in place. So thank you very much. And yeah, Donna, Yourbuds uses JBL's drivers in them. So good stuff. I think we mentioned earbuds on the show once, but it was years and years and years ago. So it's good to revisit, because not everybody listens to every show, you know, John, believe it or not.
I'm listening.
Are you listening? All right. Well, listener Michael is listening. Oh, I was going to do this and I was, oh, there it is. Listener Michael is listening most likely on his Master and Dynamic ME05 in-ear headphones. He says, I know they're not cheap, but they're around $200. They are fantastic sound, made of brass in New York. So we talked about headphones last week that were made of wood, the grain headphones, and now those made of brass. So thanks. Yeah, I've heard good things about the ME05s. I have not heard them, but I've heard good things about them. So we'll put those in the show notes too. And while we're on the subject of sound, listener Jason says, you spoke about computer speakers. Have you tried the Bowers & Wilkins MM1s? Such a beautiful sound. Just a thought. They're not cheap, of course, but lovely designed to go with the sound. So thanks, Jason. We'll put that in the show notes too. I have not checked out those. Again, I have heard very, very good things about them. And Bowers & Wilkins always comes, you know, highly recommended in our circles here. But no, I have not. Check them out. I have one more thing.
Just the name of the company. It sounds like I should know who they are.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like maybe we should talk about them in like hushed tones. Those are Bowers and Wilkins. Whoa, dude. Whoa. One last thing on the audio side, bringing the audio and tech back together. Josh says, I heard you briefly mention using an Airport Express to get AirPlay on your Sonos speakers. I would also suggest that you check out Air Sonos. While I have not tried it myself, it would be cool to see if it works. Yeah, Air Sonos is interesting. It is a piece of software that you run, and you can run it on your Mac, or you could run it. I know of people that are running it on like their Synologies or whatever, but it essentially creates an AirPlay streaming path to Sonos. So you can do exactly the same thing without having to buy any hardware, or at least not any. You need to put it on some sort of hardware, but you might already have the hardware as opposed to needing to buy like an Airport Express. Or if you don't have it, even if you have an Airport Express, if you don't have a Sonos that has a line in port, and most Sonos units do not have a line in port. The Play 5, I believe, is the only speaker that does, and they've got other kind of non-speaker things that have line in ports. But this could be your answer. So thank you very much, Josh, for bringing our attention to that. That looks pretty cool. I have not checked it out, but you got anything to add to our cool stuff found today, John? While we're tearing through these, we've got a couple left.
I think I do. So here's one. So I got a goodie box, I guess you could call it, from our friends at Ventev, who I had not really looked at in the past. And they make a whole bunch of stuff, which is maybe why I never really looked at them, because,
It was overwhelming.
I don't know why. Well, yeah, because they make stuff in cables and power accessories and stuff like that. I did find one thing. So a lot of them are similar to things are not entirely unique. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that I was trying to find the stuff that was unique. But they also make a good... Well, here's the one thing that I found that I think could be useful for a lot of people here. And they call this their desktop charging hub, and I will post a link to it.
Cool.
Here's what it does for you. So it's kind of a charging station, not only for your iDevices or USB devices, but it also provides some power sockets as well. So what does it do? So it you plug it into the wall. It has surge suppression and also tells you if the ground is correct, which is probably an important thing.
Not a bad idea. Yeah.
And then it has two AC outlets and three USB outlets, but it also, it's round, but then it has slots in it. So the idea is that you could put your iDevice or tablet, you know, it's big enough for that, you know, at an angle, or also it accommodates them. So you're sure. not putting them flat on the table or on an adjacent surface. It has a way to let you put your device in there as well while it's charging.
Cool.
Doing its thing. So $59.99 retail. Though a lot of their stuff here, when I say retail, it's just a reference point. A lot of these you can, I mean, that I search on Amazon, it's almost certainly less.
Yeah. Right. Cool, man.
But I like the status where it tells you, yes, the surge suppression is working and the grounding. I like products that do that because, you know, I actually did see a vendor that offered them and they had them in the break room, you know, like the press room, and the lights that said that the thing was hooked up incorrectly were on. And I went back to them. And I'm like, you know, your product that they're displaying in that area of the exhibit hall, like, shows that there's something wrong with their wiring. They're like, really? Wow, we should talk to them.
Yeah, you might.
It was like for reverse polarity or something. And I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm. Hey, yeah. Cool.
All right, back to you.
All right. Actually, back to the listeners. So Devin suggests, he said, and this actually looks really cool. He said, a few weeks back, you mentioned a software program called SmartDraw and their SmartDraw web client. The timing was perfect as I needed a Visio-like diagramming program for a work project. I checked out SmartDraw, and while it looked cool, it also got me into looking at other free options. I came across draw.io and was blown away at how flexible and smooth this software is. And best of all, it's completely free, or seems it so far. You can create great flow diagrams quickly and easily, save them to your desktop or directly to cloud services, and export them in a number of different formats. Highly recommend this free and awesome software. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes for sure. Thank you so much, Devin. Yeah, it's amazing what is possible on the web right now with that kind of stuff. I mean, checking out SmartDraw totally opened my eyes to this. It's, just being able to, we've never really had like a good Visio style thing available to Mac users. But now with this web stuff, we do. There's OmniGraffle, I guess, but it doesn't do all this stuff. It's not intelligent enough to do like diagrams where you can move things around and all of that. It does great looking diagrams, but the diagrams themselves aren't intelligent when you're working with them, even though the output looks good. So, yeah.
What is this? It has to be JavaScript or something.
Well, I don't know about draw.io, but I know SmartDraw is all, HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Wow. It's amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. I should get you a setup to test out SmartDraw, man. You'll be, especially if you've used Visio in, you know, past corporate lives and stuff, you'll just like, your jaw will hit the floor. It's amazing what they can do in a web browser. Like I said, using it, I forgot I was in a web browser. It's pretty impressive.
So. As it should be.
I totally agree, man. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So thanks, Devin, for bringing us back to that. And I'll check out draw.io too. But I'll put both of them in the show notes since we're talking about them. And I'll also put FastFari in the show notes. Ronald writes, the app FastFari allows you to quickly launch a favorite site in the Safari app or built-in Safari web controller. The built-in browser on iOS or the built-in browser in FastFari. Therefore, he had some other things that he was writing and I jumped in the wrong spot. Let me rewind because Ronald deserves that. He says, I'm writing today to see if you guys might be interested in an app I built. It was really made for iPhones with 3D touch, but it works on all iPhones. The main feature is that you can store any four websites you like as a set of quick actions on the home icon. The main reason I use this is due to the fact that the quick actions that Safari provides are not always what I need. The app, now we're here again, called FastFari, allows you to quickly launch a favorite site in the Safari app or in a built-in Safari web controller inside FastFari. Since the app also supports split view, so you can have two browsers open in split view, and because it's using the built-in Safari web controller, even if you stay inside FastFari, you can stay logged into any websites you already visit and all of that stuff. So we'll put a link to FastFari in the show notes. This is pretty cool. If you've got websites, like you said, that you visit regularly, this allows you to sort of pull them all together and access them quickly. And if you have a phone with 3D Touch, well, even better. You know, you can dig right in. So we'll put all of that in the show notes. Sorry for bungling the delivery there initially, Ronald. It's pretty cool stuff. And I always love it when we get a cool stuff found that's written by one of you, because that's cool. We're a community here. We're a family. So we like everybody to know what everybody in the family's up to. Even if that means, you know, staring at each other stink-eyed at the dinner table sometimes. Wait, what? How you doing, John? Mike, a couple left. Mike says, I've heard you mention several times in recent episodes that this is the year of the router. Of course, I know you were primarily talking about all the cool new tech being rolled out to improve wireless throughput, but I also hear both of you waxing poetic on the virtues of a highly configurable router. In fact, in the past few months, all of your discussion has left me wanting for something more than my 6th-gen AirPort Extreme. Sure, it's a great router. It's stable and excellent, but as you know, dumbed down about as far as it can be. That's where my search started. Based on your recommendations, I looked into several of the higher-end routers with the capability of loading DDWRT, but that is when I stumbled upon PFSense. If you don't know, PFSense is a free, open-source, professional-grade router software package built to run on FreeBSD. That's right, a Unix-based router that can run on almost any modern hardware. It will even run on a virtual machine. Once I figured out what this thing could do, I wondered why it had never been mentioned on the show before. And to be fair, we've mentioned it in passing. I think you answered a question about PFSense, John, and we, like I said, we mentioned it in passing, but never with a focus. He said it. I decided pretty quickly that I wanted to give this product a try, but unfortunately, I didn't have any spare hardware to devote to the cause. That's where it gets interesting. Based on another one of your recommendations, I looked to AliExpress to find a rig to run the router. I found a 1.6 gigahertz quad-core Celeron fanless PC, 4 gigs of RAM, 32 gig SSD, and dual gigabit Ethernet ports for $139. Since this was easily within the price range of the routers that I'd been looking at, I decided to pull the trigger. Setup was a breeze with a thumb drive installer downloaded from the PFSense website, and configuration took no time at all. In less than an hour, I had a fully functional router that was running Snort for intrusion detection, VPN, QoS, traffic shaping, network antivirus, and WAN quality connection monitoring. Best of all, with all of that running, I've yet to see my little Celeron go over 20% utilization. As a bonus, my AirPort found a new role as a wireless access point located in a much better location for Wi-Fi connectivity. I have to say that my PFSense box has been up and running strong for over a month now without a hiccup. I highly recommend you give it a try. There's so much built into this package that I just had to pass it along. Thank you, Mike. Yeah, that's what we needed, was something else to burn up all of our free time geeking out on this. But no, seriously, that's sort of the point is this. So yeah, I've heard a lot about PFSense. Your description, and the reason I went through the whole thing here, folks, is, you know, a description of getting this box and having it totally set up and running within an hour. That's the part that kind of convinced me. All right, yeah, I should take a look at this. I mean, you know, there's been things like this. In fact, this is like what's old is new again. My first router was not a router. It was a full size tower running Linux with two Ethernet cards in it. One that plugged into my ISDN modem, believe it or not, and the other that was my ISDN modem had a router in it, so it was technically not my first one, but my first cable, I didn't have a router for my cable modem, so I used a Linux box doing essentially this. Obviously, you know, in the last whatever 20 years, it's been a little more refined. So this is cool stuff. Thank you, Mike, and now I know what I'm going to do with my free time. So I'll put a link.
I ran that too. It was a while ago, but it was when I was managing an internet connection. I remember that we ran, I think it was called Firewall One, and it was run on a Sun
Okay.
With a spark.
Well, that's I didn't have any software.
But it was a computer because I actually, for various reasons, which I won't get into, but I actually needed to modify the routing table.
Sure.
It was the router, so I could do that.
Right. Right.
Rules and stuff. But it also had this commercial package to protect us from the evils of the internet.
Mine, when I did it, I was just using the firewall rules built into Linux. When there was no extra software package. It was just like, okay, well, I want traffic to route from here to there. I want to do NAT routing. Yeah, I want a DHCP server, so let's set that up too. And it was, you know, all of that stuff. It's all built in, like whatever it was. I think it might have been Red Hat. I don't remember, you know, which Linux distribution it was. This was like 1998, I guess, right after we moved to our house in Buda. So, yeah. But, you know, it's just it's all right there. It's all built in. Your Mac could do it, too. It's just sort of expensive way to route your network. Mm-hmm. So one last thing on that subject. I put up a video earlier this week. We had talked on the show about how not only do you need to be aware of your speeds, but you need to be. We talked about QoS and traffic shaping and making quality of service, making sure that when some or many devices on your network were using lots of bandwidth, that it wasn't negatively affecting other devices. And we talked about running a speed test where you also had a ping going in a terminal window and you watch the ping. And while you're running the speed test, the ping times spike, it means that the speed test is making your pings not turn around as fast as they should. And that was sort of the point at which when I did those tests, I decided, yeah, I probably should turn on QoS in my router. And I did, and it totally solved it. Well, DSL Reports makes it easier. Speedtest.dslreports.com will do that ping test in your browser for you while it's also doing a speed test. And then to make life even easier, it gives you a grade for many aspects of your connection, including this one, which they call buffer bloat. And I think we used that term last time we talked about this, John, but you know, if your buffer bloat number in your speed test, you should be doing this from a wired connection because you want to take out as many variables as you can. Right. So, you know, a computer wired into your router, do the test. If you get a B or better on the buffer bloat, I wouldn't stress about it. The sad part is most everyone that's been doing this test with an Airport Extreme router has been getting D's and F's with buffer bloat. And it's because Apple institutes no quality of service stuff in their routers. Some routers have it as an option, but even with it turned off, kind of already do some of this traffic management to keep exactly this from happening. But Apple does not. So, and there's no way to turn it on. So maybe if you run an Airport Extreme, you don't want to do this test because you don't want to find out that, you know, your router can't handle it when somebody's taking too much bandwidth. But anyway, there you go. That's what I have to say about it, John. Did you run this on yours?
I ran it on my wireless machine, and yeah, it gave me horrible grades because, I don't know, maybe because I did wireless. So I'll
it could
try
be.
It wired. Maybe yeah, I'll try it right now. You think I should do it now?
You can, sure, do it right now. I mean, what's the harm? The only harm is it would you know, short term degrade our Skype connection. But yeah, go ahead and do it. See what happens.
Nah.
All right.
Nah,
well, you know what, John? Why don't you do it while we talk about our sponsors, and then you can come back and tell us what happened.
Ah, good idea.
All right. You like free stuff? I like free stuff. You like a VPN? I do. I like to use a VPN when I'm pretty much anywhere that I don't control the network. You know, if I'm at a coffee shop, at a hotel, even if I'm at John's house, I like to use a VPN because I don't know what kind of snooping and spying that guy's doing on me. So ProXPN, if you visit proxpn.com/MacGeekGab, is a VPN that's available to you for free. It works on your Mac, your iPhone, your iPad. It's available to you for free. It's that simple. Every month, it's free. If you need more bandwidth than the free account allows, and you might. But frankly, you might not, depending on what you're doing. But if you need more, then you can use coupon code GAB50, GAB, G-A-B-5-0, to get yourself up to 50% off of all of their stuff. That's also for life, by the way. really, you just got to check it out. ProXPN.com/MacGeekGab. It's free. You should have this set up on your phone, on your Mac, so that you're ready to go when you need it. And because you can sign up for free, it's not going to cost you anything unless you need a lot of it. And then use coupon code GAB50. I've got this on my Mac. I've got it on my iPads and on my iPhone. It works great. Their overall philosophy is really what you want in a VPN company. Dead serious about privacy. They go to great lengths to maintain their users' privacy and security online. I've read through their terms and conditions. I'm kind of like a legal terms freak, but frankly, their stuff, it's not going to make a whole lot of, you know, lawyers happy with wherefore art thou and all those things. It's really easy to read. And man, they're right on top of it all. And the same team that does this testing of new software is their support team. The people that test the servers and the products and all of that stuff, those are the people answering your questions. Super easy to use. You got to check it out. ProXPN.com/MacGeekGab is where you go. Just sign up for your free account, get it installed. If you find you need more, remember you've got that coupon code GAB50, G-A-B-5-0, to get you up to 50% off of all the other services that they sell. Our thanks to ProXPN for sponsoring this episode. Upgrading your Mac is something we're always doing around here. There's always something you can add, something you want to tweak. And frankly, upgrades, especially the right upgrades, can really make it feel like you got a new computer. If you're not running an SSD yet, you definitely want to check that out. And Otherworld Computing, our second sponsor today, is absolutely the place to start. Go there, visit MacSales.com, go to SSD, plug in the number of your, or the, you know, pick the model of your Mac. It's a MacBook Pro, it's an iMac, whatever it is. And not only do they have SSDs at great prices, I mean, you know, these things have gotten so cheap. You're looking at a 240 gig SSD for $105, a 480 gig for $195. But then they'll also sell you the kit that fits inside your exact computer. So it gives you the tools, it gives you the SSD, of course, and if there's any mounting brackets or anything like that, they've just got it. They've already figured this out. They know exactly what you're going to need, and they will sell it to you and then ship it to you. They'll also give you the instructions, both written instructions as well as a video that you can watch. Their videos are awesome. I watch them all the time before I go and do an upgrade because it's really nice to be able to see exactly what it is you're going to do before you have to do it on your own piece of hardware, you know, because you got to get it right. Let's face it. You know, this is the one iMac you have and you're doing that. So you certainly want to get it right. Watch the video first. Know that you have all the exact right parts, tools, and instructions at your fingertips and then get started. Makes it super easy. So you got to check this out. Go to MacSales.com. Pick what it is that you want to put in your Mac, an SSD, memory, maybe even just external storage. Of course, you don't need a video for that. Just buy the external storage that you like and plug it in. You're good to go. They've got great deals on that. They always have great enclosures. They test everything insanely over there. They're obsessive in an awesome way. It's absolutely the best customer service and test environment that I've ever experienced. These folks really do care about getting it right. And that's good for you. That's good for them. That's good for all of us. You got to check it out. Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com. Our thanks to Otherworld Computing for sponsoring this episode. How do we do, John?
This test is nonsense.
Okay.
On my wire connection, it gave me a D, a D, and an F. Yet it says I'm getting 27 megabits down, which is what I should be getting, and 5 up.
Sure. Well, it has, so this has nothing to do with it. The buffer bloat grade that DSL reports give you is only about your buffer bloat. The speed grade that they give you is their decision about how fast your connection is versus how fast an internet connection should be. So I would ignore their grade on your speeds. If you're getting the speeds that you're supposed to get, then don't worry about it. What they're saying is, you've chosen to buy speeds that are slower than we deem appropriate.
Yeah.
But that's not correct. You know, your speeds work for you, so that's fine. It's the buffer bloat number that you need to worry about. So maybe you need to turn on QoS in your router. My question would be, did you do the other test when we talked about it like a month or two ago with the pings and watching them while the, while another speed test runs?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Cause that would be
here. It's saying idle latency is like tens of milliseconds, which
that's good. Yeah. But that's what it's checking is the delta, right? It looks at the idle latency and then it looks at the latency during the test. And if it jumps from 10 to say 150, well, now you've got, it's pretty obvious why that latency is increasing. It's the speed test. So that means soaking your cable.
Well, then it shows two graphs and they're steady, though they're at a figure that I guess is larger than they like. So, okay.
No, the two graphs are your downstream speed and your upstream speed. Again, it's testing many, many things. So, yeah, your speeds are probably, what you're telling me is your speeds are what you expect them to be. So don't worry about that. It's the buffer bloat's the only thing
I'm not going to worry about it.
Okay. All right.
I don't feel there's a problem.
Well, that's the thing, right? Yeah. This is knowledge. It's not, you don't have to take action with it, but it does help explain. Like, remember when we started doing this show, and longtime listeners probably will remember this, there were a couple of times where the middle of the show, we used to record on Sunday nights. It was after my kids would go to bed. And we'd be doing the show and suddenly I'd like have some kind of problem and we'd have to pause and I'd text my wife and find out, she was uploading, a bunch of photos because she would go and get her stuff done after the kids went to bed. And we had to tell her, stop, don't do that while we're recording because it screws up the latency. The latency is really important for something just like this, right? Where John and I are talking. Mm-hmm. If you start adding, hundreds of milliseconds delay between us, it can get weird. And
you should have been like, you should know better.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
Should be like, why is the network being stupid?
Why is the and that's what so this would have identified that for. I mean, we identified it in practice, but, this type of test would have identified it for us. And really back then, I did try to enable QoS back then because that would solve this. But the problem was, the routers just weren't fast enough 10 years ago, or at least the ones I had weren't fast enough 10 years ago to do QoS without just totally cratering your overall network speeds anyway. It's a lot of work for the router to watch all the traffic coming through, especially when a lot of it is happening at high speeds, and start like limiting things. It just takes CPU power. One thing I will say about QoS, and we'll move on, is if you try this, one of the listeners in the room said, at mattkeekab.com/stream said, I tried this and I enabled QoS on my Netgear router and it still, gave me like a horrible buffer bloat grade. A lot of times when you enable QoS, people have a tendency to set the speeds too high. QoS, quality of service, essentially what you're doing is you're telling your router, never let things get to the point where we're hitting the maximum speed of my cable modem. And that's a hard thing to swallow, right? Because you want to get the maximum speed of your cable modem. But the problem is when you do, these latency things kick in because the cable modem has to limit you. And so it just, puts a hard cap on it. And that's it. When you hit that, nothing else gets through, which slows other things down. So the idea is you tell your router, look, only hit, say, 90% of my maximum speed, maybe 95% if your router's fast enough to handle, getting that close to the limit, because it's going to spill over a little bit, or it potentially will. So you tell your router, hit 90% of my limit, both upstream and downstream, and then let the router do the shaping of the traffic. And then that way your cable modem, its limits never kick in. And that's the point. So, but it's hard. You pay for this speed. You're like, I want to use it all. Well, but you don't want to hit the limit. And that's the trick. So anyway, that's where it goes. Hey, one comment about fusion drives from episode 600. We were talking about whether or not to get a one listener we were advising a listener whether to get a fusion drive or a separate SSD and an external drive. And Tim says, quick comment about that. You indicated that the Fusion Drive SSD may only be 64 gigs. He says, I believe the 1 terabyte Fusion Drive is just a 24 gig SSD now, whereas the 2 and 3 terabyte versions still include the larger 128 gig SSD. And he is right about that based on everything we have seen in the teardowns and all that. It used to be that the 128 gig SSD was used in all of the Fusion drives, but now the 1 terabyte Fusion drive only uses a 24 gig SSD. So really no point in getting that and even thinking about splitting it, because there's not much you could do with a 24 gig SSD on its own. In the Fusion drive, though, people seem very happy with it. It's obviously Apple's software is managing it well. And I'm sure obviously this was a cost cutting measure, but not one that they made uninformed. So I think it works out okay, but be aware that that's what you're actually buying. Just so you know. So yes. So there you go. Yeah. Furby's one last thing we'll say, because he has a great analogy here. Furby says, in terms of QoS, he says, it's like a garden hose. You want as much water as possible coming out the end, but not so much that you blow a fitting. Yeah. And that's a good way of saying it. Yeah. You just, you know, only put so much in and it'll work out on the other side. That's right. Yeah. Okay. But I will say it took me probably a year or two to finally like swallow the fact that I had to not have my limits, you know, and get right. Maximum. Yeah.
Well, but anyway, you shouldn't put the pedal to the metal, even though you can. This is a perfect example.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Close to the metal.
Well, that's the trick, right? Yeah. Is you know, how close do you want to go? Yeah. It's crazy. Also on show, we'll come back to all that stuff. I do want to share one tip though from Marty, because this is handy, and then we'll get to a couple of questions here, because you know it's what we do. Marty was having some issues had a question about iCloud Photo Library, and she was her computer told her that she had migrated her data to a new computer for whatever reason, and needed to resync with iCloud Photo Library. And when she went to do that, when she turned on Photos, it said, hey, you don't have enough storage in your iCloud Photo Library to add all of these to your existing one. The thing was, what she had on her computer was mostly a copy of what was in iCloud Photo Library. She just needed to get it back in sync, but because it was a new computer, iCloud was not recognizing that. She presumed, and it turns out correctly, that simply saying, don't worry about it, don't buy more storage, just go ahead and do whatever you can, would merge things together and resync the whole thing. And she is happy to share with us that that worked. It took a few days because she had, you know, I don't know, tens of gigabytes of stuff in her iCloud Photo Library, as one would. And it worked out totally fine. It got to the end and everything was good. She said, you know, it complained to her, but throughout the process, it didn't give her a whole lot of feedback throughout the process, but she did keep the system preferences iCloud window open, looking at her storage utilization there just to make sure that it wasn't creeping close to the limit, which is really, really smart. And it never did. It never crept up. And I think by the time it all synced up, it might have even gone down a little bit, but she said she doesn't notice anything missing and everything looks good. So I just wanted to share that because we get questions like this often, and I know there's no guarantee that everybody's going to have the same experience as Marty, and you should do exactly what Marty did, which is back up your library and store it offline first. Do not leave it connected to your Mac. Have it off. And then let it start this sync. If it totally blows everything away, okay, well, you've got your local copy of your library there. Everything's good. But it worked fine. So chalk one up for iCloud Photo Library. And thanks for sharing that, Marty. While we're on the subject of photos, John, you want to take us to Joseph's question?
Oh, boy. Yes.
Okay. All
right. Joseph. Yeah, this... Well, it's a publishing photos and Flickr, but I ran into this, and I hope you verified too, but unexpected behavior. So, hi guys, I give up on this one. I'm staring at this page from Flickr, and I've tried to drag even just one JPEG file, and I keep getting a pop-up asking if I want to stay on this page or leave the page. If I stay on the page, I just revert back to this page. If I leave it, I then see a window with the image. How do you get images into Flickr.com? And actually, when I first looked at this, I'm like, well, it seems pretty obvious to me. So what happens is if you go to Flickr, which is a photo service, a publishing service, you can upload individual photos, but you can also define an album. And that's what is happening here with Joe. But he gets unexpected behavior. So what happens is it says, well, drag stuff here and, you know, I'll add it to the album for you. I think the problem is that it's doing this from within a browser. And actually, based on prior discussions, Dave, this should work. But it doesn't. Or at least it didn't work on any machines that I have. So I don't know if it's the version of a bug in the OS or Safari, particular version of Safari. But my expectation, and you can do this in a lot of cases, is that if you drag a picture from the Finder to Safari in the place where it says, you know, drag stuff here, please, it does exactly what he says. My expectation would be that it would add it to the album. It would upload it. And this is certainly possible using other environments. I don't know why it's not with theirs.
Yeah.
The thing is, what you'll also see is on the bottom of the Create a New Album window, you will also see a bar that has thumbnails of all the photos that it sees, and you can filter on this too, so it makes it manageable. So initially, I guess you see all your photos, probably in chronological order, that you've ever uploaded to them. You got to drag them from there to from the browser. You have to do this within the browser, I guess is what I'm saying, using the browser interface. But then I thought, but you know what? I've never really done this. Why is this, Dave? Because I've used some sort of photo management software. And the thing is, whether it be iPhoto or Aperture or now Photos, but all of them give you a way. And also the nice thing is that OS X does integrate with Flickr. So make sure you go to the internet accounts portion and either on your iOS or OS X or whatever you're going to call it next week. and add your Flickr account. You can. And then it'll be... So what happens, for example, in Photos is if you highlight an album and then you go to the share icon, which is the square with the up arrow, you'll see Flickr is one of the options. Then if you choose that, it'll ask you some questions, you know, title, and I think, you know, apply some conditions, and it'll upload your album from the photo management software to Flickr. So that's what I would suggest. So one is, yes, it's I don't know why it doesn't work. It should. Don't you think it should, Dave? I mean, have you ever dragged a photo from your desktop into a browser and have the thing on the other end say, yep, okay, that's nice?
Yeah, I mean,
it's
got to
be... you want to upload.
Yeah, right. HTML5 and CSS and JavaScript working together and all of that. But yeah, and I would expect that Flickr would do that. I'm with you on this one.
But I tried on two different machines. Again, they're running the same browser and the same version of the OS.
Yeah, that would be the only thing is maybe try a different browser.
I mean, on iOS, the thing is, actually, I've had issues getting my Instagram stuff to go over to Flickr. So I actually use it. So under iOS, Flickr does have an uploader. I don't believe they have one for OS X, or at least I've never had the need to use it in that. Or maybe I just don't have it because I would always use my photo software to upload to Flickr. I never would.
You're the one that told me about Flickr Uploader for the Mac, where it scans your whole library and syncs it up. We talked, and unfortunately, it was great. Worked awesome for a long time. And then it still works awesome. You just have to now buy a Flickr Pro account to use the auto uploader for the Mac.
Yeah, I don't think I ever really really gone into that feature. Maybe I told you about it, but I guess maybe I just... found a need for it. But, so anyway. You're not, to answer the question, you're not crazy. It's just, I don't know if they broke what used to work before, but I couldn't get it to work.
Right.
With the current implementation. So.
Right. All right. While we're on the photos and web interface thing and also iCloud, I think I'm going to hit two of those three with Sarah's question here. She really, it's more of a pointing it out, but she said, I was recently asked by a friend if I could show her how to set up a group in contacts so that she could email them easily collectively. It's something I've done a lot, so I thought it would be no problem, but she only has an iPad and does not have a Mac. Hence my rant. Apple does not provide a way to set up contact groups on an iOS device. It requires logging into iCloud.com, and that too is not possible from an iOS device. It seems that Apple has not seen any reason people would need to log into iCloud.com on their iOS devices, But at the same time, they've touted the new iPad Pro as a replacement for those coming to the platform from a PC, for others replacing a laptop. How can it be a replacement for something that it actually requires you to have? It seems they make no provision for someone who does not own a desktop or a laptop but wants to use, in the case of my friend, an iPhone, an iPad, and an Apple TV. I do know that there are third-party apps that can enable setting groups and contacts, but that's not my point. Apple should make provisions for this. You're right, Sarah, and it is frustrating when you try to visit iCloud on your iOS device, and really any site on your iOS device that detects what device it is and then just says, no, you have to use our app, right? I mean, it's fine if it says, you know, we've got an app, maybe you want to do it this way. But it is frustrating when you just get that brick wall and you're like, wait a minute, you know, especially with an iPad Pro, you know, this screen's bigger than my laptop. I think we can get this done here. Well, you might be able to get around it. And yeah, I tried this with iCloud. I didn't go as deep as making a contact group. But if you visit a website and it comes up in a mobile format or a way that is obvious that it's detecting what you have and not giving you the features you want, hit that same little share icon at the bottom that John mentioned. Scroll around on the bottom bar. You'll get two bars, one for sharing out and then one for sort of other functions, copying and running workflows and that sort of thing. And you will find, often toward the end, but you can reorder these, an icon for request desktop site. If you visit iCloud.com on your iPad and then hit the share icon and choose request desktop site, it will show you the normal desktop site of iCloud and let you work around that. There may be reasons why it won't work on an iPad, and you might get deeper in and hit walls, functionality walls, but your iPad at that point will be announcing itself as a Mac. So the web server should not be making any prejudicial decisions against your iPad. It's possible, again, that the software will not work. It'll, you know, be trying to do something that's not capable, not possible on a touch device, but for the most part, should work for you. So bear that in mind. It's always good to remember. Let's see, John, you want to take us to Norv?
Norv's got a real interesting one.
Let's go.
I didn't know about this.
Sweet. We got to get our three new things, man. So let's go.
I think we've exceeded that.
I feel like I certainly have. Mm-hmm. Cool Stuff Found kind of takes care of that for me. But
all right.
Yeah. Anyway.
But Norv writes in. He congratulated us on 600, saying we must have long beards. No, not really. No. I think we're both.
We shave with trimmed. Hairs. That's right.
So he has several Apple computers and an iMac that is used for family productions, is running OS 10, 10.11.4, which is the latest. It appears to be almost full on its 500 gig drive. Huh. All right, about 45 available. When I checked to see what it is filling it up using disk utility, it shows that other is the culprit. Doesn't tell me what that is. But there are tools to do that, and so he used Daisy Disk, thinking it would help me. When scanning in administrator, it appears the culprit is .document revisions -v100. What is that, you may ask? And I'll tell you what that is. So one, because it begins with a dot, it's a directory that's normally invisible. If you try to see it from the Finder, you won't be able to, even if you navigate to the root. But his question was, how do I deal with this? And I'll tell you how to deal with this, Dave. Now, this is very unintuitive. I didn't know this off the top of my head, but I eventually figured it out here. So this is a feature that they introduced in a lot of Apple programs that will actually eliminate the need for you to save, in that it will do it on occasion. I'm not sure what the algorithm is, but it'll create a version of a document whenever you make a change. And that can be handy. And typically you'll see this, I think, if you hover over the... I don't use the feature that much, to tell you the truth. I don't know if you do, Dave. Versioning? I mean, preview, I think, lets you do it. And some of the Apple program do versioning, and I think they support it on iOS as well. I've never really done much with it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, not a ton, to be honest, no.
But you may ask, well, how do I disable this? And it's totally off the wall where you have to go. But what you have to do is go into settings, general. There's going to be a box saying, ask to keep changes when closing documents. Well, if you check that box, that disables versioning.
Right.
Based on what I found. But, it'd be nice if the box was like, you know, enable or disable versioning and not ask to keep changes. Because what's happening here, by you saying ask to keep changes, it's saying, okay, I'm smart enough to know when to do this.
Right.
As far as I could tell. So that's item number one. But then item number two is Daisy just showed the stuff. Now, you want to be careful here. You know, of course, make sure all the documents are backed up. But you could go into the terminal and do a sudo rm-rf. Okay, be careful. Remember, everybody, rm-rf is recursive force. And that'll destroy everything.
It means delete everything after whatever you type next. That's right.
Yeah. And so here you would put slash dot and the name of that directory, and then it would just get rid of that directory. Right? Or I suppose you could go into the directory if you wanted to and do the, But be careful when you do this. And I think you may be able to do it from the Finder, but you have to be able to display this. And normally the Finder doesn't display invisible directories. So
easy way to do it would be to navigate there in the terminal and then do an open space dot. And that will open where with a current directory dot as a Finder window. And you can do whatever you want in the Finder. I've been using that more and more. Yeah, it's, you know, I'm a terminal guy too, right? And so I'm very comfortable there. But sometimes it's like, you know, I just want to do something in the Finder. And more I've been using open space dot. It's all lowercase, open space, period, return. And wherever you are in the terminal, now you are there in the Finder.
Nice.
Yeah, I know. That's, you know, whatever. It's kind of handy. Especially for things like this, where you're like, I need to navigate there. I'm not sure exactly where it is. And then, boom, there you go. So that's my tip for you. I told you we were going to learn new things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's next?
What's next? Geez, I don't know. You know, we'll go to PJ, because this is an interesting one. I think it might be good for a discussion, John, but maybe not. I don't know. And as soon as I find it, I'm vamping here. Here it is. PJ asks, any of you guys think of a good reason for a RAM disk? Or have you used it in the past? My only thought is if you have a gigabit Ethernet connection and a very slow spindle hard drive, a RAM disk would allow you to transfer at full speed over the network. I don't like the idea to use it for caches, but for video or other editing, I do understand it. I have a 2012 MacBook Pro Retina with a 512 gig SSD. Reads are 450 megs a second, writes 400. A RAM disk, he says, I've seen over 1 gig, but I'm routinely getting 800 megs reads, 700 meg writes. An old spindle drive from a few years ago, reads are in about 100 megabytes, writes are in the tens of megabytes. So I see the reason, right? And it's a good question. My thoughts about a RAM disk, you know, using it as an intentional cache where you're putting things there that you're going to read and write. So, you know, the term cache is sort of a misnomer, but you know, I think you have to, when talking about a RAM disk, you have to understand the one important rule. And that is when your computer turns off, the contents of your RAM disk are gone, not stored in any way. They are gone. So anything you have there is data at risk, right? So you've got to be careful. But I get it. You know, especially if you're working on something over a network or something, you might get enough benefit out of it that it's worth the risk, but you have to manage it in such a way that you're at least acknowledging that risk exists. So, you know, I don't know that I would do a RAM disk. I mean, I don't have use for one, but I imagine somebody could. What do you think about this, John?
The only thing I'd use it for would be things like the one thing that occurred that came to my mind, and I think there's still a need for this. The last I researched this is some photo and movie editing needs scratch space or workspace or temporary space.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they ask for a disk directory. Well, I think a RAM disk is perfect for that because to me it indicates that the program has identified an area that it needs to do things quickly or, you know, destructively, if you will.
Sure.
So why not have something that's fast? On the other hand, you know, I mean, well, RAM is faster than an SSD, but not by either magnitude.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I guess I'm saying maybe for something like that, but it
yeah.
I think SSDs eliminate a lot of the need for having that sort of thing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, and you know, PJ's numbers.
It's fun to play with if
support
you
support that. Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, if you need to do fast access. Yeah, I mean, how much faster, is it really going to be?
Right. Well, Baseman Mike in the chat room says it's popular for temporary storage for PC gaming for decreased loading times, right? So you take the game.
Okay, levels or whatever.
Yeah, you know, and you move the whole thing to a RAM disk, and then that way when you jump, like you said, when you jump levels or whatever, you're not, you know, just waiting for it to load and load and load. That makes sense, especially if you're talking about a game that's on a, you know, a DVD or whatever, you know, you move it to a RAM disk and now.
Wow. That still happens.
Right. I don't know. I don't play a lot of games, but I would imagine some have to be distributed that way. Don't they? Or no, you just download it and cache it all. I don't know.
I have some Steam games and those are all downloaded and then stored, but yeah, but
you could put those, you could, you know, set your Steam stuff to store to a RAM disk. I mean, you'd have to re-download it every time, but you know, I don't know. It's just interesting. That's all. I like to think about this stuff. It's fun. Hey, RJ has a comment. Speaking of fun stuff to think about, RJ has a comment about last week's show where we got at the end into all kinds of crazy things about the future of Apple. And so we'll let RJ share what he shared with us.
Hey guys, following up on your future of Apple thing, just three quick things. One, Dave, your point about having your own cloud, they should be buying Drobo/Transporter/Synology and pivot off of that to do something really good there. Second thing, they've really dropped the ball. This is RJ, by the way, in Cedar Mill, Oregon. Second thing they've really dropped the ball is the not having an Amazon Echo type product. Here's all this stuff sitting on home servers and in the cloud and everything else. Voice accessible. It's become the second most used tech device in our household. The third thing, I'm old. I learned how to program from in 1965 from Kemeny and Kurtz, the guys who wrote BASIC. So that shows you how old I am. And my eyes are going. So this gray font stuff that's so popular on the Mac OS and the web too, screw it. Give me some contrast. Thanks a lot, guys. Shut me off.
You got it. Thanks so much, RJ. Yeah, that was a fun little discussion to have last week, John. It reminds me that we should, you know, do that not every week and perhaps not even every month, but give ourselves the freedom to do that every now and then because it is kind of fun. It's the kind of stuff we would talk about if we just got together and talked. So it's fun. We've got a couple of other things on the list for today. Anything in particular that you want to jump to, John, or shall I pick? Actually, there is one. Look at the rest. I want to go to this thing. In the last show, we talked about avoiding double NAT on your Verizon Fios connection. And we talked about the fact that there was, or what we thought was the fact, that there was no way to do this. Well, we were wrong. And several of you pointed, many of you, in fact, pointed this out. I'm going to play Scott's comment and then Jan had some specific details to share, but I think Scott will explain it well. And then we'll add, Jan wrote us this amazing email. He's like the text ASCII, diagramming master. This dude doesn't need smart draw or draw.io. He It was amazing. He cooked together this email with different colors and stuff, and it was all just text, and the diagrams made perfect sense about how you should plug things in. But I think because we're in audio form here, we'll let Scott do this, and then I'll bring some of Jan's stuff in to clarify.
Hey, John and Dave, it's Scott from Los Angeles again. Still haven't been caught, hopefully, knocking on wood. In episode 600, you mentioned a problem with DoubleNAT and Verizon or Frontier, Fios. The other option you can do is without the ActionTech modem at all, if you're OMT, that's the box that they usually put in the garage or right outside where Fios comes in, there's an Ethernet jack. And if you go straight from that into your Apple AirPort with DHCP turned on, you'll get your outside IP address. And that should eliminate the problem of DoubleNAT, and it's a lot faster. But it all depends how they've hooked that up. Sometimes they hook it up with coax from the street. Sometimes they hook it up with Ethernet from the street. All right, thanks again for the great show.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah, as it turns out, they are doing, in some cases where he said they're using coax, sometimes that coax from the street is actually MoCA from the street. So they're sending Ethernet over the coax. And then sometimes they're using MoCA in the house to get things to the other devices. But a lot of times, in fact, either way, it seems like you'll get an Ethernet jack in that ONT box, which is that box on the outside. And that Ethernet jack is ready for you to plug your router into, with one caveat. And I sort of distilled this down from Jan's awesome diagram. So you will have two things plugged into your ONT box. You will have, as Scott just pointed out, something plugged into your Ethernet jack, and that's your router, and then it can distribute stuff. And then you will have your ActionTech TV box plugged into the coax side, because you need that for your TV. However, Jan's done a lot of testing with this, and the problem is your ActionTech box, if you have a router plugged into your Ethernet port, your ActionTech box will not be getting a local IP address on your network for you to be able to control it and do things locally. So you have to plug the Ethernet port from the ActionTech box into one of the LAN ports on your router so that it gets a DHCP address. And it sort of, it seems like you're creating a loop, but you're not. You're just completing the circle, really, so that all of these things can interact with each other, and yet your router still does what it wants to do as a router. Kind of crazy, but that way you don't have to deal with DHCP fighting and resetting and all of that good stuff. So that's thank you guys so much for all that. And there were many, many others. Michael, in fact, was kind of on the list of helping explain all this to us. So hopefully we've communicated it to you as succinctly as possible. But if you have any questions, let us know. Obviously, there's quite a few experts here that we can either ask or refer you to, depending on their personal privacy limits. All right. John, did you pick another one, or are we jumping to Brent?
Yeah, let's jump
okay
there.
All right, fine. Brent asks a question that is a topic that we've covered a few times, but it's a good one. He says, being that it's the year of the router, I have a router question. Currently, I have the latest AirPort Extreme. Both the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz SSIDs are named the same. I live in a three-bedroom townhome slash row house. It's not very large, and the AirPort Extreme is in the office on the top floor. The house is two floors and a basement. Obviously, everything hooked up via Ethernet up there is getting fantastic speeds. When I'm on the floor with the router, everything is joining via, he says via N. I think he's saying via 5 gigahertz. It's good not to confuse 5 gigahertz and 802.11n, because you get 802.11n on both 5 and on 2.4. But maybe he's talking about AC. So things are joining fast on that floor. He says, now the issue, the TV, Apple TV, and PlayStation floor are on the first floor, but not that really far away, not really that far away from the office. But when devices connect to what I believe would be the 2.4 gigahertz radio, the speed test on my iPhone, Apple TV, and PlayStation 4 only get about 20 megabits down, and of course 10 megabits up, which is his maximum. But the 20 megabits down is not the same as the 170 that he gets up in the office. I did a little experimenting and changed the 5 gigahertz radio's SSID to a different name. When all of those devices are connected to that, slightly better speeds, but the signal strength and network reliability is an issue. It worked fine one day. The next day, the Apple TV couldn't even see the 5 gigahertz network. I've tried a bit of experimenting with the 2.4 gigahertz channels. All seem to have gotten about the same speed test results, 20 down and 10 up. My questions. Am I right in thinking that 2.4 gigahertz should be faster than 20 megabits down? Number two, outside of moving the router power line Mocha, is there any other Airport Extreme setting I'm missing? And number three, if I were to get a new router, something like either the Synology RT1900 or the Netgear R8500, which would you choose, or is there a better one? And would they potentially help coverage in the house? Okay. Well, you're asking the right people. These are good questions. So question number one, are you right in thinking that 2.4 should be faster than 20 megabits down? Well, I mean, maybe, maybe not. The only way to really test that would be to go up next to the router and connect via 2.4 and do a speed test there. That will start to give you your limits. But it almost doesn't matter, right? Because it depends, although it might. I mean, maybe there's something wrong with your router and the 2.4 is just malfunctioning, right? More than likely, though, you'll get fine speeds when you're up next to it, even on 2.4. And it just sounds like you have a lot of interference between the two devices. Using something like iStumbler or Now, have you checked out Dabuki's new wireless mode, John?
Yes.
This is awesome.
I was going to talk. Yeah, I hadn't. Yeah, because I recently had downloaded the license for it because, you know, I'm rebuilding my system here. But yeah, they have.
I've been using it a lot.
Yeah, it doesn't. I guess my question is, I think at this point, it doesn't show the actual payload, but it shows statistics about it.
Yeah, what's cool is it puts your Mac into a really different mode. Like iStumbler's fine, and it tells you, it's actually quite handy. You stay connected to your wireless, but it shows you all the other wireless networks it sees and gives you what their security settings are and their channels and all of that stuff. Dabuki will show you that, but it takes it to the next level. It shows you every wireless device in your house, whether it's an access point or a client or sort of neither, right? It shows me all my Sonos devices and they're like only connected to each other. I just have them set up in mesh mode. And it'll tell you of your client devices, what radio they're connected to, like what SSID they're attached to. So it's giving you a lot of cool information. This would have helped you and would still help you diagnose in Brent's scenario here, what radio, you know, when they're both set to the same SSID, what radio is my Apple TV, you know, attaching to? You can just, Dabuki right. would tell you instantly. Oh, it's that one. Great.
One thing I do want to mention is, so your question is, you know, what speed should I be getting? One thing that's important to look at is, and you'll see this if you go to the airport menu and you hold down Alt. Dabuki, I don't think, gives this. It gives something similar. But the thing is, one of the things that happens is your radio and the base are going to negotiate a transmit rate, right?
Right.
And that's reported if you hold down the Alt key and look in the airport window. It shows you between your computer and the base station what they decided is the maximum rate here. So I see 450 megabits per second. So in theory, the maximum throughput I'm going to get is about 45 megabytes.
Divide
by 10. I always divide by 10. Just to
hey, are you turned away from your mic? Are you like on one computer and turned to the other?
I move the mic.
Okay, so, we were getting some weird like breath sounds. Yeah, much better. Yeah, okay, cool.
There we
thank
go. You. Yeah, no, I had cool. I had it.
I kind of figured while you were experimenting. Yeah, of course. Cool. All right, so that's question one. Are we good with question one?
Yeah, I just want to make sure to mention that somebody has already decided.
Yes, that's
how
right.
Fast you can potentially go.
Yeah, based on
whether you're going to see that. You know, and I've seen that. And the other figure, you know, if you search for this, you'll find it. But I think it's called MCS index. And that's another value that says, all right, you know, we talked about it. And here's what you're going to get.
Yeah, here's how it's going to be. Yeah.
Well, Dabuki shows the actual throughput, which is interesting in and of itself to see if that, you know, how that correlates to what they've negotiated.
Yeah.
That is actually kind of interesting. Like I said, the question I have is, does it show the payload? And I don't think it does at this point.
Right. I don't think it does. I think
but it's showing statistics about the environment. You know, it's funny because you say, you know, it shows what's in your household. Actually, Dave, I'm looking here and
I
got some Sonos devices recently that I forgot I bought, or one of my neighbors has Sonos because I see three Sonos devices show up in the vendor list, and it doesn't currently show they're associated with a base. So they may be like in idle mode or something.
Well, no, they're probably like me in mesh mode because you can
Okay.
You can either have Sonos attached to a base in Wi-Fi mode, which is sort of the new new option.
Okay.
Or the initial default way that Sonos did it forever was, and still does, if you want, is they create their own mesh. You connect one of them to your router via Ethernet, and then the rest just sort of, you know, mm-hmm. talk to each other and come up with their own thing. But
nice.
Which is cool. Yeah. All right. So outside of moving the router and or power line or MoCA, are there any other Airport Extreme settings you're missing? No, I don't think so. If you do testing in close proximity to the router and you're still not getting the speeds you think you should be getting, and all the stuff that we just talked about doesn't give you any reason for that, either interference or whatever, maybe a firmware reset of your Airport Extreme would solve it. I mean, we've seen that, you know, with odd issues, you kind of running the gamut. But no, I don't think there's a magic setting for you here, unfortunately. Number three, if you were to get a new router, sorry, John, do you agree with that?
Well, I'm just going to laugh because the cycling power solved the problem that I had, though it was much less of a problem.
Sure.
Was towards the end of the show last week, I said, wow, the power LED on my TP-Link Archer is off. I'm like, why is that? Well, you know how I solved it? Cycled power.
Yeah. It happens.
The software at some point must have, I think it's a mistake or a bug. All of a sudden it's like, yeah, let's turn off the power LED and see what he thinks about that. Yeah. I'm like, oh, what?
All right. So number three, if you were to get a new router, what would you choose and would it potentially help? So I don't have a current gen Airport Extreme to test, so I can't compare. But I do have a similar setup to you where I've got a router on the top floor of my house and then two stories below it. So, you know, essentially in the basement, same, you know, setup as you. I've got a TV and things down there, right? I recently moved from using the Netgear R8500 as my router. That's the crazy tri-band, with router with, they've got the amplifiers for the antennas are actually in the tips of the antennas so that they don't suffer from as much noise of the motherboard. I mean, they've gone nuts with this thing. However, I recently moved from using that to using the Synology router that you asked about, because just to test it, I have this, I don't know, maybe it's a pipe dream, John, to be quite honest, that I could use stock firmware in a router someday. And I felt like the Synology firmware might be it. You know, I'm obsessed with DDWRT. I'm very addicted to all the flexibility, but the Synology firmware is pretty darn flexible and it's really robust because it comes from, you know, years and years of them building the same type of firmware for their NAS devices, the disk stations. So anyway, so I tried that and I am trying that. In fact, this show, our connection, John, right now is going over the Synology and it's good. Their QoS is kind of weird, to be honest. It needs a little help, but the rest of the interface is awesome. It even does local DNS and it does all the different VPN options I want because they just copied those from the disk station. So it's all very kind of mature and all that. But for that particular connection, the connection from the router on the top floor to devices on the bottom floor, you know, two floors down. So 3-1 in terms of floors, two sets of stairs. The Synology is negotiating slower speeds on the 802.11ac side, on the 5 gigahertz side. Not terribly lower, but consistently like a notch lower, where I would get, you know, I'd get a connection that would read, you know, in the stats is about 1,000 megabits. You get about half of that. This one is reading a max of about, you know, 750 or 800. Typically, sometimes it creeps up to the 1,000, but it's never staying there. And so that's clearly, you know, the result of the the differences between the Synology and the Netgear hardware. So, but that Netgear router is crazy. It's the strongest I've ever seen. So perhaps in your scenario, it might be exactly what you're looking for, Brent. You know, something with just gobs and gobs of ability. And it's not just about power. It's, you know, about filtering and the way the radios are designed, and the way the antennas are designed, and, you know, all of that. But it definitely, you know, and this is true elsewhere in the house too, but certainly from that 3-to-1 thing, third floor to first floor, there's a noticeable drop in speed. It doesn't matter for what I'm using it for. I'm still getting hundreds of megabits of throughput. And, you know what, a month ago I was using power line in that place and getting like, you know, 50, cause I don't know, I've got noisy wires in the basement. So it's, you know, it's fine. It doesn't impact me, but it's there. So this might solve your problem, but it might not. It depends on what you've got in between you there. You know, I mean, if there's like, I don't know, concrete in the floors, I can't imagine there are, you know, I mean, there would be in your basement, but not in between, but maybe in between. I don't know. Or, you know, if you're trying to go through a refrigerator or something, because that just happens to be between, you know, the router. I mean, essentially, you know, you're probably like me. You've only got one floor between you and the, you know, between the router and where you want it to go. But I don't know what you have on that floor. On ours, it's actually Hector that sits between. So Hector's getting a full radiation treatment of 2.4 and 5 gigahertz. The router basically sits right above her. And then the TV in the basement is right below her. So
Hector manages traffic in a sense.
In a sense, Hector. Yeah. Hector manages traffic. That's right. Yeah.
For network traffic.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
She's also slowly being cooked, but
slowly.
That's another story.
Well, you know, yeah, that's right. That's right. So she is, we do call her our jungle chicken. So, you know, so I don't know, but it's worth trying. And, you know, if you buy the R8500 from a place where you could return it, this would answer your question. But, you know, for less than $200, you could buy, and I really want to try these. I hopefully within the next couple of weeks, I'll be able to. The new ActionTech has two Mocha, has a, you know, for like less than $200, I think it's about 170. You can get a pair of their new Mocha 2 bonded adapters. And from what I hear, like those things are going to like begin to approach true gigabit Ethernet speeds, like from some of the tests I've seen. So I want to put my hands on them and really test them out, because I'm getting, I put a stupid little $6 point of entry filter on my whole house network, and my Mocha speeds went from about 200 megabits per second to like 275. I mean, it was just night and day. Wow. By putting this,
well, the purpose of that filter keeps the riffraff out, right?
That filter keeps, yeah, it essentially filters all the Mocha stuff from coming in or out of the house. So you put it, you know, I put it before my amplifier even. I mean, it literally is the first thing that the cable line hits. And it doesn't negatively impact or positively impact the cable modem or anything else. It's all like all my signal strengths, all of that are exactly the same. It really only impacts Mocha. But for $6, I thought, well, it's, you know, whatever. It's a flyer. Fine. I'll try it, you know. And it was like, holy cow, this is awesome. So, and it does it. Yeah. It keeps the riffraff out, and it also keeps my traffic. Theoretically, it keeps my traffic, my Mocha traffic, from traveling up the stream. But if you listened last week, you know that I unintentionally tested that by trying to go Mocha from the house to the office, which are on two different streams from the pole. And I was not able to. So I'm not overly concerned that for a week I had people sniffing my Mocha traffic. So, I don't know. That's it.
Yeah, you always got to think about that. You know, I remember one day when we lived at my original home,
yeah,
that we found a neighbor. So back then we experimented with getting a household intercom that,
sure,
was using RF. And so, you know, we get it, and you could choose from three different channels. And so we get the thing, and all of a sudden, like that evening, we're hearing voices that we don't recognize. And we're like, what is going on? And all of a sudden we went to one of them. We're like, hello? They're like, hello. They're like, yeah, we're at whatever road. Where are you? They're like, oh, yeah, we're down this. Like, oh, okay. You want to change the channel or me?
Yeah, which one of us is going to do it? That's right. Fun stuff. Good show, folks. Thanks for all the great questions. I want to call out our premium listeners that asked and shared stuff during the show. Scott, Michael, Jim, I believe that was a second Michael, the second Michael listed. And then Marty, Joseph, Sarah, PJ, and Brent. I think I've got everybody. So thank you so much to all of you premium listeners. Thanks to everyone. But if you are interested in becoming a premium listener, visit us at MacGeekGab.com. You can sign up right there. And it really does help us out if you're interested in Able. And if you're not, as you saw, we certainly answer questions and share tips from everyone, of course. But just wanted to call out a special thank you to all of our premium listeners. And a special thank you to Hector for managing the traffic well while we did today's show. Oh, John, I don't know where to go from here. I want to thank CashFly at CACHFLY.com. How do people want to get in touch with us, John?
Heck, you know, we might as well talk about Twitter. So, there are a number of things. I just put this in our chat room here. If you want to get in touch with Hector D. Byrd, Hector D. Byrd is Hector, the letter D, B-Y-R-D on Twitter. I'm John F. Braun. He is Dave Hamilton. The podcast is Mac Geek Gab. The publication is Mac Observer. Oh, and Pilot Pete, who's piloting.
He is.
Somewhere.
Yes.
But we are all on Twitter. One big happy family.
That's true. That's true.
I'm still amazed that Hector can tweet. That's just...
Well, she has all that bandwidth at her disposal when she sits there. That's the thing.
But she could learn to type.
She could. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is another way to get in touch with us. We would love to hear from you that way. Unless you're a premium listener, in which case, premium at MacGeekGab.com, of course.
Feedback at MacGeekGab.com. I think that's what I heard.
Feedback at MacGeekGab.com. I also do want to thank all the folks in our podcast marketplace. Gazelle at Gazelle.com, of course. Smile at SmileSoftware.com/geek, where they always have their special deals for you as listeners. Squarespace at Squarespace.com/MGG. As we mentioned earlier, Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com. ProXPN VPN. I'll say that right. At ProXPN.com/MacGeekGab, where you can get a free VPN. No reason not to have it set up. The folks at Barebones Software at Barebones.com. And of course, Casper at Casper.com, where MGG saves you $50. All in the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. John, we've made it through 601 shows now. And I want to share a piece of advice to everyone. Two pieces of advice. You know what? We're gonna stretch this out a little. Two pieces, each worth three words, six words. Number one, do everything you can to beat the system. Number two, in the process of that and everything else, don't get caught.
Made up.